Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Folklore, a podcast of the New Books Network. I'm Tim Thurston, one of the hosts of the podcast, and today I talk with Bill Ivey about his new book, Rebuilding an Enlightened World, Folklorizing America, recently published with Indiana University Press. Bill is former director of the National Endowment of the Arts, former president of the American Folklore Society, and a vocal advocate for the study of expressive cultures both within the academy and beyond. In the book, Bill posits that we are entering a new post-Enlightenment age that increasingly questions science and fact in favor of things like belief. In this information environment, the foundations of traditional sources of authority appear ever weaker, and Bill believes that folklore studies, and particularly the brand of folklore taught and studied in the United States, can offer important tools for understanding this new age. The chapter titles in order read Enlightened, Understanding, Identity, Negotiation, Stories, and Listening. And it occurs to me that the story could equally be read in reverse. Modest listening to the stories people tell help us negotiate with people, understand identities, and ultimately work towards being more enlightened. Overall, it was a fascinating conversation, and I hope you'll listen to the end, where there were some really interesting comments made for not just the American condition, but also beyond. Thanks very much for listening, and I hope you enjoy. Hello, and welcome to New Books in Folklore, a podcast where we talk about some of the latest books in the field of folklore studies. I'm Tim Thurston, one of the co-hosts of the podcast, and today I'm joined with Bill Ivey. Bill is past president of the American Folklore Society, former chairman of the National Endowment of the Arts, and an author interested in arts, culture, and policy. And today we're going to be talking about his new book, Rebuilding an Enlightened World, Folklorizing America, recently published with Indiana University Press. Bill, welcome to the podcast.
Tim, it's good to be here.
Well, we're delighted to have you. And I guess I was wondering if you could sort of start off telling us a little bit about yourself. What's your folklore origin story?
Well, like many of my age, my generation, became interested in folklore through a passion for folk music. I was a guitar teacher and earning a degree in history at the University of Michigan. And as I was wrapping up my undergraduate career, I wanted to go to graduate school, but I wanted to study the music that I cared so much about. And fortunately for me, the wife of the head of the Herb David Guitar Studio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, where I was working, had been a student of Richard Dorson's at Michigan State, and had actually attended one of the summer folklore institutes at Indiana. And so she told me about the Indiana program. I applied and was enthusiastically accepted, even though I hadn't been that great an undergraduate student. But I had grown up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, where Dick Dorson had done his early research for excellent book, Bloodsuppers and Bearwalkers. And he wanted me at Indiana. And so I was admitted and given a little money. And that brought me into a program that really wasn't very interested. In fact, in a way, was actively uninterested in folk music or the folk song revival that was then here in the mid-1960s in full swing. And I followed along with the opportunity. I became very interested in the relationship between oral tradition and historical narrative, oral history, and was actually about a third of the way into a doctoral dissertation on the history of the community where I grew up, Calumet, Michigan, where there had been a very important labor strike, a very important strike back in the early teens, in 1913. And so I shifted away from that emphasis on folk music toward historical narrative, oral tradition. And then suddenly, when, like many of us in the early 70s, when I was unable to find a teaching job in folklore, I had the opportunity to join the staff of the Country Music Hall of Fame in Nashville. And that led to a full career, more than 20 years as director of the Country Music Foundation. And while I didn't have the title folklore scholar on the door, I was always able to use my folklore training in the operation of a museum that dealt with a very traditionally grounded part of America's popular music heritage. So folklore, even though I spent large chunks of time not really working as a folklorist, folklore was always there. I always attended meetings of the Folklore Society. And I think at every stage of my career, that training and that way of looking at human behavior and that way of looking at community always influenced me and was always extraordinarily helpful. It helped me frame the realities that I was looking at. It helped me understand where people were coming from, what were the underlying motivations of people when they came to me with arguments about what should or should not be done around culture. So maybe a longer answer than you wanted, but starting with trying to play guitar in imitation of Mick Reynolds of the Kingston Trio, moving all the way to the opportunity to be the head of the U.S. Cultural Agency, the National Endowment for the Arts, during the Bill Clinton administration. Folklore was always very, very important to me.
It's really wonderful to have somebody who's been on sort of been involved with folklore for so long and on so many levels. It's really a really wonderful opportunity, and I think that comes out in this book. It's really an enjoyable read. Doesn't read like many of the sort of more some of the drier tenure books and things like that that come out of dissertations. And I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about how this book came to be. As I gather, it's kind of from the preface, it seems like it's kind of an interesting story. It seems like it may have had some, well, I'll let you tell the story.
I had written two books about culture and public policy, and I was wrapping up my work with Vanderbilt University in probably 2014 or 15. And Gary Dunham, the director of the Indiana University Press, asked to have a meeting at the American Folklore Society conference in the fall of 2015. And I said, sure. And I met with Gary. He said, how about doing a book that takes your interest in public policy and somehow brings it together with folklore? Because we at Indiana, we're working hard to establish the press as the premier publisher of folklore books, and we want a range of materials. We don't only want academic studies. We want some things that are perhaps a little more oriented toward the general public and might reach out to a broader readership. And I immediately said, yes, not knowing what I was going to actually write about. And he wanted the manuscript in a year, which would have been fall of 2016. And he said he wanted 40,000 words, which for those of you out in the listening audience, no, that's a short book. That's a 95-page book or something like that. And so I had agreed. And then I began to try to figure out what I was going to write about. What was the connection between folklore and public policy? Obviously, there were things that folklorists had done over the years, working with government agencies. And the U.S. government had different institutions in the Smithsonian and the Library of Congress that studied folklore material. But that isn't really what I wanted to write about. I wanted to do something perhaps a little more energetic, a little more aggressive. And I just wandered in the intellectual wilderness for 2 or 3 months, trying to think of what had gone wrong in the world. Why were things so upset? What were the underlying themes around the lack of respect for science, the lack of respect for conventional institutions, the resurgence of right-wing, ethnically based politics in many countries around the world? And this was in my mind. What's the underlying cause? And can folklore scholarship say anything about it? And I remember, almost to the day, I remember the experience. I was walking beside Lake Superior near a summer house that I have up in that part of the country, far northern part of the U.S. Midwest. And I just said, well, maybe the Enlightenment is just ending. Maybe the Enlightenment has run out of steam, just as any great intellectual transformation ultimately ends. The Renaissance ended. The Industrial Revolution ended. These things have a period of time in which they're resonant and powerful, and then they fade. And then there were forces out there that I think that I began to think may have contributed to the stumble of the Enlightenment. And so what began to take shape in my mind was this notion of perhaps what we're experiencing as the Enlightenment either ends or has hit a rough patch is a resurgence of the kind of tribal and ethnic and religious sentiments that have always been there, not only in rural areas, in tribes and isolated communities, but woven into every part of modernity. And while I'm thinking about this and working on it, I think, well, all right, I'll do a kind of history of folklore and talk about key personalities and make that kind of the story of the book and have public policy and international issues and American politics kind of woven into it. So that's how I started. And in 2016, I wrote 30,000 words and I brought it to the press and they didn't like it and I didn't like it. And so I went back and started over, this time putting the public policy piece a little bit more in the foreground, folklore and folklore studies a little bit more in the background. And that became a more satisfying approach to me. So I still had the problem, and this, for anyone who's written a book, particularly one of this sort, where it's really an idea book, a big challenge is what I would call the architecture. Here's my overall idea. The Enlightenment has weakened. Traditional informal culture has come forward. It's the thread, it's the intellectual thread that links in public policy the Taliban and the Tea Party to Trump, who was by that time when I'm writing, he was an emerging presidential candidate. And to me, that was the overall theme. How do I put that into different sections? So that became the primary problem. And of course, then Trump is elected. He immediately starts talking in the language of science denial, distrust of established institutions. He becomes a kind of spokesperson for anti-Enlightenment thinking. And so I was able to use him. The book is not about him, but I was able to use both his comments and the way the press and other observers responded to his comments to make my beginning argument. This is what's coming back. And suddenly, leaders who thought they understood that we lived in a world of law and regulation were suddenly forced to confront the truth that we live in a world of norms, of stories, of customs, and spotted through the language of criticism of what Trump was up to were words that were really folkloric. He's violating, he's not observing traditions, he's ignoring customs, not behaving according to norms. And that means he was really not properly participating in informal culture. At the same time, our social science experts in psychology and social science and sociology were quite desperately, I think, trying to explain the motives behind extremism, religious-based extremism, particularly when the recruits into those movements were young people who had other opportunities. They were middle class. They had decent educations, and suddenly they were traveling to the Middle East to take up with ISIS. And why was that happening? And here again, I felt that the notion of archetypes and of mission and of the heroic quest that is so well known to a certain category of folklore scholar perhaps did more to explain why people were motivated to do things that were dangerous and even horrific to themselves and to others. And so this began for me to point me toward a way of organizing the book in terms of, let's have a chapter on identity. Let's think about the motives for people who are involved in a dramatic quest. Let's think about the meaning of stories and why stories can be more important than laws or regulations or even facts. And let's then try to wrap up by saying, well, how can we be different? If we still believe that Enlightenment values constitute a global improvement over centuries of ways, established ways of life, how do we bring the best of Enlightenment thinking back into the world in a more generous, more negotiated way? And always for me in the background was the belief on my part that it's the perspective or the stance of folklore scholarship that at this time can give us the most productive way of engaging these very vexing issues.
I'm wondering if you could sort of unpack this idea of being post-Enlightenment a little bit. Because it's not that you're necessarily seeking to throw the baby and the bathwater out both together, but sort of recognizing the reality and seeing how we can push forward, take what is good from this moment and push forward. Is that right?
When I started work on the book, I went in thinking, well, the Enlightenment is ending, and we're really simply observing some kind of transition that we can't yet define or totally understand. but it's over. And then as I looked harder, two things struck me, and I ended up writing quite a bit about them, more than I it's something I an idea I came up with as I was actually working on that second version of the book, which is that the Enlightenment by itself is a set of abstractions, human rights, participatory government, the autonomy of the individual, a whole set of ideas. But those ideas by themselves don't have any capacity to create policy, to create change. They have to be interpreted, in a sense, brought down to earth by individuals and movements that define them in one way or another and convert those themes into action. And this is where I think it's possible to look hard at the isms, the Marxism, Darwinism, populism. There are dozens of them. And the way in which they have, in a sense, corrupted or reworked the basic meaning of Enlightenment values. And in some cases, when you talk about imperialism or colonialism, you're talking about movements that may have gone forward behind the banner of enlightened thinking, but in fact were dismissive of or repressive of tribal, communal, long-established ways of life, long-established sets of values. And my thinking changed from arguing that the Enlightenment is over and we have to think of what the New Age will be like, to the Enlightenment has been poorly executed. It hasn't, it's been poorly served by the many isms that have taken the language, sometimes the ideas of Enlightenment, certainly in language, and simply used that language as a way of imposing power and control. So it made me, in a sense, more optimistic, because I then began to think, well, maybe we can figure out a way to get it right. Go back out in the world, still thinking about human rights and participatory government and women's rights, and so on, as values, but without the hard edge of a kind of colonial mentality that tries to extend our way of thinking out and impose that way of thinking, sometimes with force, on the entire world. And I began to think, well, what would be, you know, what does the Enlightenment have to give up? Well, maybe we shouldn't be so focused on the individual. Maybe the unit in the world that engages power is the family or the community or the tribe, village. And we criticize our own society because of our focus on the individual. And we see it as a source of kind of selfish me generation. And so I think there is an opportunity to begin to think about the world in a way that maybe is a little bit more engaging and a little bit more open to the kind of knowledge that these multiple societies, these ancient ways of being, to the knowledge and understandings that they have generated. So it's not just our way, it's let's negotiate this. Let's try to find a way to work on work these things out together. But I don't, it requires it's a mind change. It's a change in point of view. And I don't think it's something that will be accomplished easily. I wanted Rebuilding an Enlightened World to be one of the books that talks about the big challenges facing the world today. And there are a number of them out there, mostly written by very established policy actors, Madeleine Albright, former Secretary of State, or Richard Haass, the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, or John Kerry. I mean, these are the people who are offering us big ideas about where we are and what we need to do and where we're going. But I think they're those arguments are mostly very inside the assumption that the Enlightenment is forever, that it's a permanent fixture of world thinking, and that every new idea has to automatically stand on the shoulders of the Enlightenment rather than reconfiguring parts of the Enlightenment. So I really felt, as I got into the work on the book, that there were specific ways in which folklore thinking, folklore scholarship could comment intelligently on problems that we were facing, and that there were also opportunities for the stance of folklore to help lead us toward solutions.
Right. Well, that sort of in many ways very nicely encapsulates some of the major ideas of Chapter 1, Enlightened. Each of the chapters has a different single word title. In Chapter 2, you sort of at the end of Chapter 1, you suggest that folklore can sort of provide these tools for moving forward from or building on or realizing the potentials of the Enlightenment idea. And then in Chapter 2, you sort of push forward this. Chapter 2, entitled Identity, sort of tries to help us better understand the American identity as a border metaphor. And you specifically draw on the work of two folklorists, Americo Paredes and his work on the southern borders of Texas, and Richard Dorson's work on communities in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how Paredes and Dorson help us better understand the United States identity and this border metaphor in which, to quote your own writing, distinct cultural formations come into contact and stimulate a search for novel combinations of available resources.
Is one of the things that I wanted to do was look at the work of folklore scholars and see how it connected with themes that one would see in the newspaper, not every day, but say every week. And I think that notion of American identity is a critical question that comes up again and again. And the U.S. has both the challenge and the luxury of not living living within the environment of romantic nationalism. We think of ourselves as being citizens of a country in which we're capable of identifying ourselves as, in some ways, hybrid. You know, you're Italian American. Maybe it's really near Jewish American. And apart from Native Americans, no one in the U.S. has that kind of historical, heroic connection with language and place. In my opinion, the U.S., Americans have never been able to take that reality and bundle it into a positive, centralized notion of who we are. And so I wanted to bring forward what I would call folkloric thinking, folkloric stance on identity by looking at the work of these two scholars. Dorson went out into the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, I think not knowing if he would find anything that qualified as folklore at all. I mean, this was a remote part of the U.S. It was ethnically very diverse. It had a Native American population. It was very prominent, very visible. But yet, these were people here, even in the 1940s when Dorson was doing his research, They were reading newspapers and listening to the radio, and they were very much caught up in kind of rural modern life. And I don't think he knew what he would find. And I suspect, although I got to know him quite well, we never really chatted about it. He never really talked about what a thrill it must have been for him to have found not only European-style genres of folk tales and legends and so on, but also some interesting community historical narratives that were really ways in which people negotiated their sense of identity and their connectedness in a community in which people had very different backgrounds in many cases, began speaking different languages and so on. And that notion of something being assembled out of difference, to me, is really a characteristic of a border environment where cultures bump up against one another. There's trade, there's different food. All of these things are kind of there side by side. No one has an obvious upper hand, and it's up to the people to work it out. And I think you can take what Dorsett observed and blow it up into a kind of metaphor for the American experience, making it more complex. I mean, Dorsett was not, he later in his career, he did work with African-American communities, but he was really dealing with Native Americans, did not deal with race in a very direct way. But you could blow up his idea of how those communities functioned into something that's a metaphor for the way the U.S. works. And for Amerigo Paredes, who had a career as a performer and as a journalist, came to folklore scholarship rather late, he saw that border, that Texas-Mexican border area, the Rio Grande area, as border with built-in conflict. Here you had contention, you had suspicion, you had attempts at domination, people responding to outside political power, the Texas Rangers, and all of this gets translated into stories and songs through which people explain their situation and negotiate their identities. And so to me, those two approaches, Dorsett seeing borderland as accommodation, Paredes seeing it as an arena of conflict, those two things, I think, take us a long way to explaining the larger American experience. And again, to understand where you are, I always try to honor my epigraphs. I have several at the beginning of the book, but one of them is about to understand the future, you have to begin by understanding where you are. And I think if Americans can admit that we are living in a border, that border makes us unlike most other societies, and that the challenge is to really find a way to take the reality of conflict and accommodation and border setting and bundle that, combine that into some kind of a vision of togetherness. It's that last step that hasn't happened yet. It takes a conversation at the deepest, at the most fundamental level to really begin thinking this way. But to me, the notion of identity and what the folklore position, folklore attitude, folklore approach can bring to understanding identity is kind of a critical starting point. And again, it's one of the issues that Americans talk about all the time. Who are we? Who are we? And I think it's an opportunity for the approach of folklore to walk in and make a real contribution.
Right. I completely agree. And I also wonder if it's a sort of, particularly this idea of identity, if it's always in a process of becoming. You say we haven't gotten there yet. I wonder if it's sort of, if we'll ever get there, even if we get to a better place.
It is a big challenge because the nature of the border is that it is uncertain. It is fluid. It's not established. I mean, if you were to fix it and say, now we know exactly what it is, it might be that it would be ruined. You know, that it may be more a process than a destination. But even that, even to understand that, I think would be move our understanding of society forward.
Right. So moving on, chapter 3 is entitled Understanding. And it looks at the work of, specifically of mythologist Joseph Campbell, and also at questions of terrorism. And sort of, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how thinking about myth or the monomyth or things like this can help us better understand human behavior in ways that, as you suggested at the beginning, other disciplines, and particularly social science disciplines, seem to struggle with.
This chapter was interesting for me because as I worked on it, a theme that I had not anticipated began to creep into the book. And that is a criticism, a critique of the role of social science in explaining human behavior. I was trying to write about behaviors that seem baffling to traditional social scientific explainers. Terrorism is one. Serial murder is another. And they seem to be they seem to go beyond the range of what social science could explain or answer. And I was also writing at an interesting time. Psychology had really come under legitimate criticism because a number of important psychologists had kind of facilitated the enhanced interrogation techniques employed by U.S. military and intelligence services after the 9/11 attacks. The pollsters, who I think of as being kind of the minions of social scientists, have failed to predict the outcome of the election of 2016, and there were other, the persistent inability to talk about people who were motivated to become terrorists, and how did that happen? And I, rather than go to what I would call external explanations, that is, childhood experiences or economic deprivation, those kinds of things, I thought that it might be worthwhile to look at the work of Joseph Campbell, who has kind of been in and out of folklore studies. I was very pleased. Elliot Oring gave a talk at the most recent American Folklore Society meeting, arguing that folklore scholars should do more with big ideas. And in the process, he did talk about Campbell. And of course, Campbell was a mythologist looking at the ancient traditions that were often carried on in epic poems that connected societies with heroic actions of the past. And what Campbell put forward was the real possibility that people then and even today would act out of these themes of heroic quest. And he attempted to compare myths of many societies and develop a set of actions that the hero would always take in the quest to save society. And these themes were taken up within popular culture, and most prominently, they were the inspiration for the structure of the Star Wars movies. And what Campbell was really saying was that apart from psychological or the sociological or the economic explanation for human behavior, there are deep shared human impulses that relate to these themes of heroic quest, and that it may be a humanities understanding rather than a scientific analysis that takes us further, closer to an understanding of why people would abandon economic security, abandon social standing in order to engage in something that is dangerous, but possibly heroic. And so again, just as I think Dorson and Paredes offer a different look at how the American experience can be identified and characterized, I think Campbell gives us a way of thinking about human behavior within community in a different way.
Oh, wonderful. I thought it was really interesting the way you sort of interwove, the way these sort of discussions are interwoven, particularly in this chapter. Chapter 4, entitled Negotiation, then sort of takes this, you sort of started by saying you look at sort of this question of social sciences, and you take it and the engagement of academic relation disciplines with policymakers. You sort of take it even further in Chapter 4, and you begin with this sort of discussion of the American Psychological Association's connections with, I would say, torture program in the United States. But beyond that, it also, I mean, the majority of the chapter looks at the process of establishing the Smithsonian's Folklife Festival and the Library of Congress's American Folklife Center. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about this chapter and sort of how it fits in with the goals of helping us understand this sort of post-Enlightenment idea and folklore's place in it.
Yeah, when I turned in my second version of the book, and I think it grew to about 45,000 words. That's where it has ended up. Gary Dunham gave me notes on the book, and this was the chapter he liked the least. He didn't think it worked very well, and it didn't. It was a move. It was a chapter in which I basically wrote about folklore scholars and their relationship with government. And I knew that it was a weak chapter, and it was kind of inside. And I kept thinking and thinking and thinking, and it finally came to me that folklore studies has had a fairly limited relationship with government. I mean, there are some institutions. There have been programs. National Endowment for the Arts and the Smithsonian, and the U.S. Library of Congress, but it's been a fairly modest connection, and so I started to think, why? And folklore scholars have often been quite disturbed by by the lack of attention. Oh, we're more important. Studies we do are people we work with, very valuable. Well, that hardcore policy attention has never emerged. And I began to think, and this was a change in thinking, just as I discovered some things along the way as I was writing Rebuilding an Enlightened World, this is something where I changed my mind. And I began to see that folklore scholars have been quite cautious about taking up the role of handmaiden to public policy. And then I looked briefly. I didn't have time to do any kind of deep study, but I glanced at the way so much of European folklore scholarship had been caught up in nationalism, romantic nationalism of the 19th century, and how easy it was for folklore scholarship, because it talks always about identity. It has stories that are grounded in history, in the work of rural populations. It's very easy for folklore to become co-opted or utilized by often very dangerous policy actors who wanted to validate their assertions of power by invoking these ancient tales and ancient myths, common language, and so on. And this goes from fairly modest nationalist enthusiasm to something like Nazism that clearly used folklore as a way of solidifying a sense of national unity and a sense of all of the others who were inferior. And in looking at it, it made me realize that, again, and this goes back to the American, the U.S. context, that U.S. folklore scholarship has been blessed by the absence of a clear sense of single national identity. I mean, U.S. simply doesn't have that sense of shared myths, shared language, common tales, a kind of shared ethnicity. And as a result, with all of the struggles we've had internal with racial minorities and other minorities and external, working with immigrants and negotiating with the rest of the world, as many problems as we've had, we still have that advantage of not coming at the other with a strong sense of identity mired in this mythic past. And so I began to see the American folklorists as being a kind of tentative participant in the government. And you actually had Richard Dorson and others arguing that the government was in a sense corrupting the scholarship. And then there was a very, very important episode in the fairly recent past in which the American Folklife Center was given an opportunity to conduct some research last minute in advance of the destruction of many communities in the Mid-South, just in advance of the construction of a dam that would flood small towns, farming areas, Alabama, parts of Tennessee. And one folklorist leading the charge sort of said, no, we can't do that. That's a kind of immoral alliance, even though it would have been a big research project for the field and would have brought folklore into a financially lucrative situation. Many scholars could have participated in the study. And the American Folklife Center basically said, no, after a lot of internal debate. I was one of many observers who thought that was a mistake. I thought this was a missed opportunity. But as I began to see the way in which economics and sociology and psychology had, in a sense, sold their souls to public policy actors, I began to see this reluctance on the part of folklore to get engaged in in government work as being something really a positive. And I completely changed my interpretation, my sense of the meaning of the American Fourplex Center's not getting involved with that salvage research right before communities were destroyed, to see it as something positive. And it's almost as though folklore scholarship, without really thinking it through completely, has kind of kept itself immune to the undermining forces of government. And if today someone were to say, all right, folklore field, help us. How do we rethink State Department? How do we rethink the way in which we deal with race or rural communities? What can you bring to the table? I think folklore today could come into that alliance with a lot of sophistication and a lot of caution and could probably have a better outcome. And I will say just selfishly that working that chapter through was very satisfying for me because it was a chapter where I started without much. And I think in some ways, it's at least internally within the field of folklore, I think that chapter is perhaps the most aggressive and maybe will be the most argued about of the chapters in the book.
Hearing you say it like that, it does start to make a lot more sense. It was initially, I was also a little bit confused at first. Hearing you say it like that, it starts to fit in. And I have to say that following this chapter on negotiation, the next chapter, probably my favorite of the book, is called Stories. I personally loved it because I think it touches on what I personally, and in my very humble opinion, consider to be one of the most exciting subdisciplines of folklore scholarship at the moment, and that's of legend. The chapter just touches on a whole bunch of really current and emergent phenomena, from urban legends and conspiracies online to fake news, Dave Isay's work in the Amazing StoryCorps project, and also, you know, sort of older things like Delheim's Folklore's Nature and the Sun's Myth. And in this chapter, I'd say, I think my favorite quote is when you say, if the Enlightenment was enabled by print technology, our new world of magical thinking, weird combinations of fiction and reality, ISIS rants and right-wing ideology is empowered and accelerated by our new thing, the internet. And I was wondering if you could talk then a little bit about the power of legend in the United States and how folklore's attention to legend can help us sort of navigate this transition from Enlightenment thinking to post-Enlightenment.
If you think of legend, not so much as a specific genre, but as a process by which stories are constructed and reconstructed and shared in order to incorporate views of reality, in order to explain reality, in order to create the foundation for future action, and that this is all informal. This is not, you know, this is not being done by the New York Review of Books. It's not being written about in Foreign Affairs, except by accident when they would perhaps find themselves conveying a folk narrative about something that happened in wartime or in a State Department negotiation. But I think that notion of storytelling being a critical part of the way human beings organize reality in order to explain reality, explain themselves, and stimulate others to action is really critical. And when we talk, as Tim and Sue and I were talking about at the beginning of our conversation, with the Enlightenment, as the Enlightenment stumbles, the cracks in the enlightened, in the prideful, enlightened array of rules and regulations, laws, as those kind of give way to action that's stimulated more by stories, this is, I think, the space where the insights of folklore, the scholarship, can add the most to good public policy, because it's a way of looking at what we see and read and hear in a new way, and gives us a new set of tools for understanding that while truth may not be there in a literal sense, there are important meanings that need to be engaged, and I think folklore scholars should own the study of fake news, because I think fake news is an extension of the kind of legendary storytelling that folklore scholars have been dealing with for many decades, and I think we're the ones that have the handle on this, and I'm hoping that our colleagues will pick this up and work with it, because when it comes to that world, we're the smartest guys in the world, the smartest women in the world.
Yeah, I would also say that I just saw a new volume about that seems to have been published, I think just a week or two ago, and I'm really looking forward to picking that up and hopefully doing a podcast also in the future with the editors of that. I think it was Trevor Blank and others. So I totally agree that especially in this world of fake news, I think this should be, we have tools in place, and hopefully folklorists will have more voice for that. The final chapter of the book is called Listening. And in it, you sort of look at sort of Henry Glassy's sort of modest listening as a way of sort of as an extra way of sort of moving beyond perhaps you just sort of said the pridefulness, but also maybe sort of the arrogance of trying to impose certain ideas on other people, and instead being willing to listen to alternative knowledge systems. And I was wondering just if you could talk a little bit more about sort of how listening fits into this array.
When I began work on this chapter, I happened to be reading Henry Glassy, Ireland, Turkey, and other places, and Irving Goffman at the same time. And of course, Goffman is sociology, but he deals with rural cultures, and I was reading, he writes about the crofters. Well, you know, crofting is a very unusual shared land use system that you find in Scotland. And if you read Goffman, you never meet the crofter. You get categories that deal with crofters, you know, social organization, who are the leaders, who are the managers. And everybody is in a category and then talked about in terms of their category. When you read Glassy, it's the other way. It's you meet a lot of people, and you have to kind of pull out meaning from a set of individual experiences that Henry doesn't go in and analyze. And he certainly doesn't analyze people in terms of their social standing, their economic position, their psychological, you know, history, and so on. And it gave me a very strong feeling that even though I think some of my folklore colleagues like to think of themselves as social scientists, I think the field tilts pretty heavily toward the humanities. And I mentioned earlier, we were talking about another chapter, that as I was working on rebuilding, the book really became something of a critique of the stance of social science. And I don't think I say it in the book, but I'll say it now, that I almost feel we're at the end of the era of social science. Something we're seeing in the inability of polls to get things right, and the corruption of psychology, and the inability of sociology to explain violence and terrorism, that if you go a decade or two with those established explanatory social scientific fields failing to answer questions, I think we're going to see a turning toward some other way of engaging reality and of explaining behavior. And to me, that requires not going out with a set of categories that you impose on what you see, but going out and listening and thinking about how people organize their own lives. I mentioned this in relation to the introduction, but the U.S. has this glorification of the individual, and the Enlightenment thinking placed the individual at the center of good public policy, and so it was the individual who had to engage power. If you go out in the world and listen, it's almost always a family or a clan or a tribe that is the key unit that's engaging power. And just to begin to listen, to me, is to understand that pulling out individuals from a clan or a family in another society in terms of, say, sending girls to school, we're going to educate girls. Well, that's great, but you have to understand that the context often means that you have to work with the family or the community to make something like that work. And I think we've really not done well in that regard. My time in China, I'm so fascinated by the role of religion and spirituality in China. You don't have that U.S. style organized religions, but you have a very strong sense of ancestors still around. You have a strong sense of spirituality connected to nature. There are meditative and worship practices that are followed, but in a different way. It's a sense of spirituality as being always present, perhaps not as strictly institutionalized. And again, I think there's so much to learn from going to societies that are unlike ours, and not beginning by saying, here we are, here's what you need to do, but go there and say, begin by listening. What can you tell us? What do you think? What do you want? And I think we ask those questions too infrequently. I go on at some length about the U.S. State Department and the way in which over the years, particularly back in the 1950s, during the era of intense anti-communism in the U.S. and McCarthyism, the way in which the State Department punished some of our smartest people, particularly those who were dealing with China and Southeast Asia, because they told us true things about Mao Zedong and about other leaders who had captured the imaginations of their people. But because they either had taken up or in some way utilized the language of Marxism, suddenly the people who carried the messages back were treated as though they were anti-American. And so you had a tremendous a diminution of the State Department's capacity to be a message-sending system that would bring alternative knowledge from the outside world back to American leaders. It became an institution that was perpetually set on send and never on listen. And the good listeners, who had in some cases spent years learning the nuances of the societies where they were posted, they were pushed aside, ignored, and new State Department officials didn't have that capacity.
That's really fascinating. I think it sort of says just again and again, just how listening being such an important part of folklore and folklore studies, this is another area where maybe folklorists can continue to be of benefit. So we've used up a lot of your time today. And I was just wondering if maybe you could ask if I could ask you just one more question, and that's what you're working on now.
Well, one of the things that became fascinating to me while I was working on this book was the importance of the biographies of folklore scholars. We don't know nearly as much as we should about not just the scholarship, but the factors that made these leaders what they are. I mean, Dick Dorson in particular hasn't been studied. We need more about Ben Botkin, who's an important guy who is 14 or 15 years older than Dorson. If you look at the array of early leaders, and the society was very male-dominated in its early years, it's much less so today, but if you look at Dorson and Alan Lomax, Amerigo Paredes, and then Archie Green, who comes into the field rather late, these four guys, they were all born within a couple of years of one another. Very different paths in folklore scholarship, and I think looking at how those individuals influenced the whole, I think it's something that I'm really interested in. And then I become really fascinated by this. Something I didn't write about at all, but I think there is a set of folklore scholars, American folklore scholars, who really defined an entire arena of American popular music as being folk, essentially. I mean, these are, you know, I'm thinking about Ralph Rinsler and Archie Green, and a number of Roger Abrams students who took bluegrass away from country music and made it a kind of folk music. They took urban blues away from R&B and made it a kind of folk music. And I think the influence of folklore in kind of making sure that America saw certain parts of its popular culture as being folk, essentially, was a very important deal, and it's a big research project, and I don't really have the ability to get into it at my age, but I think it's something I would like to hand off to others. And then I would say finally, I became convinced that the American approach to folklore scholarship, which really has to do with modernity and folklore interwoven, often in urban settings, is a very, very important approach. And I think it's the one that probably will lead the way into the global expansion of folklore work. That I think at the moment, Europe and even some of Asia operates under the burden of romantic nationalism. And romantic nationalism brings government and power and business into the field in a way that I think is hurtful. But I think the U.S. approach, not too enmeshed with nationalist objectives, and very accustomed to finding the traditional side-by-side with the official, is really the way of the future. And I think there's almost an opportunity for someone to write a new book about the American approach to folklore studies.
Well, both sound fascinating. I can't wait to see even the early stages. I feel like we'll make tremendous contributions. Bill, we've used up a lot of your time. Thank you so much.
I've enjoyed it, Tim. Good talking with you.
Likewise. Thank you.